Hi, everyone. I'm Siobhan Sarna. This is Petunia, the kitty. There's my book, Healing SIBO. And this is Alicia Galvin. She is a wise, wise gut health expert and has tons and tons of alphabets after her name, as I like to say. I'm going to take a minute here just to read them to you. Alicia Galvin, MEDRDLDIFNCP, registered dietitian, clinical science liaison with Microbiome Labs. She also has had her own practice since 2014, with gastro issues and diseases being her main focus, such as IBS, IBD, SIBO. Also, she is focused on fertility, autoimmunity, and chronic inflammatory conditions. So she's spent years practicing in clinic and helping patients make their own customized solutions. And she's also an educator for Microbiome Labs. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today to speak about this topic.
This topic is metabolic health, spore-based probiotics, your gut, and blood sugar levels and leaky gut, and what you can do to help it, and the unintended consequences that we see in this cascade of symptoms when things are out of whack. I'm going to let you take over, and then we'll do some Q&A at the end. And we do have a coupon from Microbiome Labs too for the 15% off. Don't know how long that will last. So if you're interested, Clarissa will put that in the chat for you. Thank you, and go for it.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining today. I really am excited to talk about this because, you know, when we think about, and as Siobhan and I were just chatting a little earlier, you know, the whole GLP-1 agonist and this whole term of metabolic health and metabolic syndrome has just exploded in the last, you know, few years. We'll talk about that at the end.
No worries.
And I'm happy to dive into that a little bit more in the Q&A, but you know, things like Ozempic, which have been, you know, distributed, I feel like, much more often these days to help with things like weight loss. But, you know, when we think about why someone's even in that point of having weight issues, diabetes, insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease, fatty liver, you know, the list goes on and on. We have to think about why is that happening and where is it coming from? And that's where the gut really plays a huge role. So I like to start with this simply because it brings to light, and many of you, I'm sure, are wondering, what the heck is this? We're looking at the bacteria, the mucus layer, and the intestinal epithelium. So the lumen is the, you know, if we think about our intestines, it's a tube, right? So we swallow food, it goes through an esophagus, goes to the stomach, and then it goes to another tube, which is the intestine. And in that innermost part is the lumen, which is where we have bacteria. It's where we have any bacterial byproducts. And so all of these little yellow and red and pink little dots that look like sprinkles are all of our bacteria. Then we have this layer. It's called the mucus or the MUC2 layer, and it's sterile. So as you can see, we don't have bacteria here. It's really the only place in the body that is sterile. You know, blood actually has some bacteria in it. Urine has some bacteria in it. This is the only part of the body that is sterile. And there's a reason for that, because the epithelium, which is that first layer right underneath the mucus layer, is really the barrier between what's happening in the lumen and what's happening with the immune system. And so if there's a breakdown of this MUC2 layer, along with an epithelium that's got, you know, leaky gut, you know, the tight junctions that are compromised, then that's when we get this immune activation inflammation. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So this is just a schematic. Some of you have probably seen this before listening to Cron. But if we think about, you know, a healthy gut versus a leaky gut, healthy guts have, you know, a good diversity. They have low levels of pathogens. They have a really strong mucus layer. They have strong tight junctions. Whereas if we have leaky gut or if we have dysbiosis, that's when we have an imbalanced microbial system. We have low keystone strains, which are things like Akkermansia muciphilia, Faecalibacterium. These are what I like to call Instagram influencers. So they make up about, you know, just 1-3% of our total microbiome, but they have a disproportionately large influence on the overall health of our microbiome. And Akkermansia specifically has been linked to improvements with lots of different metabolic health outcomes, lowering, you know, the risk for things like diabetes and obesity. So if we have low keystone strains, that's not a good thing. That means we've lost our Instagram influencers. We have low diversity with a leaky gut. We have low short chain fatty acids. We have disrupted mucus barrier, and we have a disrupted mucosal immune response. And if we have a dysfunctional gut barrier, then that means that we have all of these different inflammatory byproducts that are coming from our gut and coming out and into circulation where it can activate the immune system. So what I want to focus on with this story is the role of LPSs and what they're actually doing when they're able to get through that intestinal barrier system. So first of all, what's an LPS? Some of you have probably heard about this. Some of you, this might be a newer term, but essentially it's an endotoxin. It's just a component of the outer membrane of the gram-negative bacteria. And there's a particular part called the lipid A portion. And this is the portion that is most toxic. So this portion, if it's able to get out into circulation, and then that's what then causes this immune activation, and it can be very inflammatory and immunogenic. So in this story of LPSs breaching from that lumen, from that innermost part and getting into circulation, what can happen is that first we have this breach. So we have this intestinal barrier that's disrupted and these LPSs are getting out. Then what happens is LPS binds to this protein. It's called LBP or LPS binding protein. Think of this as like a taxi that comes and picks up the LPS. And then that taxi shuttles it to an immune cell, like a macrophage within the immune system. So the LPS climbs in, gets into the taxi of the LPB. And then what happens is it will bind to this particular, what's called a TLR4 complex. And when it binds, it's like driving into the driveway. It's like it's coming in and it's parking in the driveway, ready to go to then activate the immune response. And what it'll do is it'll flip on something called NF-kappa-B. Think of NF-kappa-B as your master switch to flip on inflammation. So when the taxi comes and picks up the LPS and drives it to the parking lot, parks it there, activates the immune cell, and that flips on inflammation. And that's when if we get this happening often enough, it'll cause this chronic low-grade inflammation, which then is what will lead to various different metabolic disorders. So breaking it down in that way, we then want to think about, well, then how can we come back from that? And we'll talk about that as we go through the talk today. So metabolic endotoxemia, it's basically an immune response that comes from these circulating levels of LPSs. And it's estimated to affect about 30% of the Western population. I would argue that number is probably pretty low considering how many metabolic disorders we have, but that is what the data supports. And it's characterized by those higher LPSs, especially after a meal. So these LPSs tend to be the highest in circulation about 4 to 5 hours after we've eaten. And we'll talk about why that will be. But meals that are high in fat, specifically saturated fat and denser in calories, tend to worsen this condition and tend to cause a greater influence or a greater increase in these LPSs into circulation. And again, as I mentioned, it will activate various inflammatory markers, and it also can, these chronic metabolic endotoxemia has been shown to have these negative correlations with chronic disease. So this is what we're dealing with, and this is what's probably underlying, you know, many, many, many of the chronic diseases that we are seeing in our westernized cultures, because essentially you can link this to infertility, to low testosterone, to PCOS, to even things like cancer and fatty liver, and the list goes on and on and on. This is just a summary on just a few other conditions. We're not going to go through all of this because that would be a 2-day seminar, but you can see it ranges anything from constipation, so GI issues, to depression, to chronic pain, to Parkinson's, to autoimmunity. So there's really a link to pretty much every condition to LPSs and to it starting in the gut and the breakdown of the gut barrier and to allow these to translocate through. So why does fat cause these to be higher? Well, this was a study that was done in animals, and what it was looking at is how do different types of fat cause this increase in LPS? Is there a difference between saturated versus an omega-3 or a unsaturated fatty acid? And they found that that happens because when we're eating, we eat fat, it goes into our digestive tract. Our digestive tract creates these what are called lipid rafts that come in and they take that fat into the body to be able to be digested. But that lipid A portion looks very, 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 very similar to saturated fat. So as the body's trying to pull in the dietary fat from that lumen to come in and to be absorbed and to be processed, it looks at that lipid A portion of the LPS and says, oh, well, you look like something we need to bring in. And so it'll bring that in. And so this is where things like saturated fats, coconut oil, lots of butter, lots of fatty, you know, saturated fat from meats actually increase that pulling in of the LPSs. However, what they found here was that things like fish oil and cod actually reduced the endotoxins, whereas vegetable and olive oil have more of a neutral effect. Now, I'm not recommending that you go out and start switching everybody to vegetable oil, because we know that that's a whole nother conversation with, you know, just the effects of vegetable oil that can have an inflammation. But as it relates to LPS coming in, focusing on things like olive oil and omega-3s, if you're wanting people to increase their fat, that would be something you would want to focus on. So the type of fat matters when you're working it with their diet. And so endotoxins are generally reduced when you substitute more of the omega-3s versus the saturated fats. So endotoxemia with different metabolic conditions. Let's talk about what the research shows in terms of this actually happening in real life. So this was a study that looked at, okay, we know that people who have metabolic syndrome have different, you know, dysbiosis profiles. And so what happens if we develop some sort of a lifestyle intervention with some diet modifications? Does that do anything to the gut? Does it do anything to these endotoxins? And what they found was after this intervention with diet and lifestyle, that there were changes in the gut microbiome, specifically with changing things like acromantia, helping to increase acromantia and Faecalibacter and prosnitzii, but also helping to reduce something called the Prevotella-Bactroides ratio, which is essentially just a ratio of two different types of bacteria groups that when they're elevated, they tend to be more correlated with metabolic health issues. So improving that ratio of those types of bacteria tends to help to improve the metabolic outcomes in individuals. And so they saw that lifestyle intervention significantly improved these metabolic syndrome components, including things like metabolic endotoxemia. So that begs the question then, what comes first? Was it the fact that, you know, type 2 diabetes and obesity is driving this endotoxemia, or is the endotoxemia and the LPSs driving the obesity and the type 2 diabetes? So which came first? This was a study that came out of the American Diabetes Association. And what they looked at was essentially that question. And what they found was that the inflammation and the binding of LPS to that TLR4 complex, to that parking lot, so to speak, that essentially is the triggering factor for insulin resistance. And so essentially, it's this LPS that could be driving the obesity and the insulin resistance. This was another study that was looking at similar questions. And essentially, they came up with in their conclusion that the use of LPS and that LPS levels can actually be the driver of type 2 diabetes and could even be a predictor for type 2 diabetes. So even before you start to see the presentation of the syndrome, before you start to even see some of the insulin changes in the lab levels, there might actually already be an elevation of these LPS getting through that gut into circulation, binding to the TLR receptors, and starting to trigger that insulin resistance. This is a summary of many different human trials that was looking at all these various, metabolic syndrome, fatty liver, obesity, liver disease, cardiovascular disease. And as you can see, pretty much in every single situation, LPS levels were increased and LBP levels were also increased. Remember, LBP is that taxi that comes and drives up and picks up LPS to then shuttle it to the immune cell to then activate the inflammation. So if you have an increase in taxis, if you have more available taxis to come and pick up LPS, then you're going to have a whole lot more ability for them to bind to activate that inflammation. So, okay, we know it's a problem. We know this is a thing. So how do we manage it? What are some things that we can do? Well, obviously diet and lifestyle. So decreasing alcohol, making sure that you have somebody who's eating a really nice fibrous, whole foods type diet, rich in macronutrients, reducing that saturated fat intake, but also prebiotics and probiotics, because as we will see, things like acromantia and faecalibacterium and short chain fatty acids all play a role in also reducing metabolic endotoxemia levels. So how can we rebalance them? What are some things that we can do? You all have probably, if you've listened to Siobhan and to Kron, you guys are very familiar with this study, but I just think to reinforce the topic of what we're talking about, when we've shown that with our Megaspore, that spore-based probiotics can help to reduce these dietary endotoxins. So this was a study that was looking at 30 days. So they had people who ate a fatty meal and they looked at their baseline levels of endotoxins, and then they compared them to a placebo. So there was a treatment group and then there was a placebo group, and the treatment group received 2 capsules a day of the Megaspore, and they measured their baseline endotoxins, and then they followed them for 30 days. They remeasured both groups with a meal. And what they found was that those that were taking the Megaspore had a 45% reduction in those endotoxins, whereas the placebo group had a 32% increase. So essentially, there was about a 77% difference between the groups. So Megaspore was starting to help to heal up that those intestinal junctions and to help with the mucus barrier to help to prevent those LPSs and endotoxins from getting into circulation. The other part of the study that they looked at was ghrelin, which is our hunger hormone. And what they found was that those that were taking the probiotic had decreased levels of ghrelin. And so that helps with managing appetite and promoting fat storage. And so having a reduction in this hunger hormone can help with reduction in appetite and helping to reduce that, if they were eating higher fat foods or helping with some of their appetite management and their food intake. The other thing that they found was that with the probiotic, there was a reduction in insulin after the meal. So as you can see in the red, at baseline, they were in the blue. And then after they ate for 3 hours and then 5 hours after, there was a trend in insulin being reduced. So there was more insulin sensitivity to that particular meal. They also saw that interferon gamma was reduced, which is an inflammatory cytokine. So it showed that there could have been some reduction in inflammation as well. They also looked at triglycerides. And in this, they saw that after taking the spore, there was a significant decrease. Now, if you look at baseline and post-supplement, you can see that there's really, and that's where I put that line there, there really wasn't that much of a difference in the triglycerides in the placebo group, but you can see there was a 24% reduction in triglycerides. So again, speaks to that metabolic help that the Megaspore was able to do. So how can we also increase short chain fatty acid production? Well, short chain fatty acids, there's many reasons why, and we'll talk about some of them, or we can just dig into a little bit deeper into the Q&A, but one of the things that short chain fatty acids do, butyrate does this, acetate and propionate also can do this, but they essentially can suppress that TLR expression. So if you're suppressing TLR expression, that's like somebody coming up and putting barricades up in that parking lot or in that driveway saying, nope, no taxis can come in and park here. So if you're blocking that, or if you're reducing that expression of that TLR receptor, then the LPS can't come and drive up in the taxi and bind to then activate. So one of the things that short chain fatty acids do is to suppress that TLR expression. The other thing that they can do is they can suppress the availability of LBP, or the binding protein. So essentially we're reducing the number of taxis that are available to come and pick up the LPS. So short chain fatty acids are really critical in this whole schematic of metabolic endotoxemia and helping to reduce the ability of these LPSs to exert their inflammatory actions. So this was our study that we did. It's our synbiotic study that was combining MegaPre with Megaspore. MegaPre is our prebiotic fiber. And it was looking at keystone species. So that it was saying, okay, well, can we increase with a combination of the specific fibers with these spores, can we increase our keystones? And we can. So it showed that there was an increase in bifido, there's an increase in lacto, there's an increase in faecalibacterium, and there was an increase in acromantia. The other thing that we saw was that short chain fatty acid production increased 80 to 140%. So we can see in both donor one In their ascending colon, their transverse colon, there was a significant reduction in total short chain fatty acids, as well as butyrate and acetate. This is a newer study that came out from us just last year. It was published. And the question around this was really looking at visceral fat. Visceral fat is our most inflammatory fat. It makes up about 10% of our total body fat, but it's one of our most inflammatory and it's associated with insulin resistance. And it was looking to see if we give prebiotics and probiotics, specifically the spores and then one of the fibers from MegaPre, can we actually change mRNA expression? So it was a 90-day study, and it was first aiming to see if we can reduce inflammation in weight-stable individuals. And then the second aim was to see if there was any changes in the body fat distribution. So the question really is, can we shift somebody's metabolic health independent of weight loss? Because we know weight loss can improve metabolic health, but can we improve metabolic health without having any weight loss? So it was a small study. It was about 15 participants, but it was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. And the supplement group received one of the oligosaccharides, it's the Xyla oligosaccharide, as well as Bacillus subtilis HU58 and Bacillus coagulans SC208. So there are two of the spores that are in Megaspore, and they took 3 billion CFU a day. And then the placebo just received a rice flour capsule. And the experimental design, they looked at mRNA expression at baseline, 1 month, 2 months, and then at 3 months. So what does this mean? So let's go back to genetics just real quick, because this is really important. Basically, our DNA is the template. So we all have a DNA code, and that DNA code basically is the code that tells us how different proteins in our body are expressed to basically do all of the jobs of the cell. So everything in our body is reliant on some sort of DNA code. But for that protein, for those codes to be expressed, it has to be built into proteins. And mRNA, which is messenger RNA, is the thing that helps to encode the proteins. And there are different mRNA sequences. There's different basically recipes or codes that are involved with different pieces of metabolic health. So with adipose tissue, systemic inflammation, and with chronic disease. So if we think about this in an analogy, DNA codes for proteins. Proteins are the workhorses of the cell. So let's say you have your grandma's cake that you really want to make. The cake is like the expression. That's what you want to create. Well, you first need a recipe. So you go to your grandma and you say, "Grandma, I need you to transcribe or write this recipe out for me so I can then produce it." So the recipe is like the mRNA. It has to be first transcribed. And that's that first step for protein expression. So it's transcribed by the author, so your grandma in this particular case, and then she gives you the recipe, and then you translate it. So you then read that recipe and you follow a sequence of steps to then assemble and make the cake. And that's how our genes are expressed, is through this process of transcription and then mRNA going out from the nucleus of the cell to the cytosol, then being read, and then you get that protein assembly, and then the gene is expressed. So this is where epigenetics come in, of what we eat, our diet and our lifestyle changes gene expression. It's basically, there's a few other ways, but this is one of the ways in which we can change our genetic expression through our diet and lifestyle choices. And so this is what they were looking at to see, does taking this blend actually do this? They also looked at DEXA scans. They looked at visceral adipose tissue. They looked at height and weight. And then they were given the, like I mentioned, the three capsules daily, and there were no changes to diet or exercise habits during the study period. And so what they found was that there wasn't a significant percent change in body mass, body fat percentage. So these all were about the same. However, the change in visceral adipose tissue, which is the most inflammatory fat that is associated with insulin resistance, after 90 days, there was a 35% reduction, which was significant. So this is important because basically this is saying we can change metabolic health through just our probiotic and prebiotic supplementation without changing body mass. So in conclusion, we saw that it changed, it affected 15 of these different, you know, messenger RNAs, and that were associated with inflammation, adipose tissue inflammation and chronic disease. There was that 35% reduction in visceral adipose tissue. And then it supports that an anti-inflammatory effect can help, you know, can come from these supplementations without changes to weight, which I think is pretty fascinating when you think about it, because so many of us are so focused on, you know, weight loss and all of this, but just by changing our, you know, bacterial expression and helping to increase short chain fatty acids, we may also be able to get some of these metabolic effects as well. So what else can we do? Well, we want to try to increase diversity. Time-restricted feeding is one of those ways. Acromancia loves intermittent fasting. So intermittent fasting is a great way to increase diversity and to help to increase your acromancia. We can increase fiber as well as fiber diversity to help with that short chain fatty acid production. Polyphenols are great. So berries, any of your brightly colored fruits, berries, you know, are a wonderful option. Plums, purple cabbage, correct deficiencies, specifically vitamin A, zinc, iron, and folate. Get dirty, get in the dirt, go out there and dig in the dirt, play in your garden. Don't be afraid of, you know, using, you know, just regular soap. We don't need to be doing a bunch of chlorine cleaners and antibacterial products. And also get a dog. If you don't already have a dog, get a dog or a cat, if you would like, something that's going to help to increase some of those other microbes. Be mindful of EMFs. Supplementing with other things like fatty acids, glutamine, vitamin C, colostrum is another way that can increase secretory IgA, bacillus spores and Saccharomyces boulardii, and address the adrenals. Stress is one of the worst things for our body. Overall, it changes our microbes. It changes our, you know, inflammatory responses. So those are really important for stress reduction as well. So in conclusion, we know that this all comes from increased intestinal permeability. And basically, when we allow these inflammatory markers to get out into circulation, that's what leads to chronic inflammation. And there's mounting evidence of this role in many metabolic conditions like type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And, oh, I thought I had another thing, but those are, that's really, you know, kind of what we're wanting to talk about here is the effect of how much our gut health influence our overall health, and that we can really do specific things to help with it. So it's not a lost cause.
Thank you for ending on such a hopeful note. It's not a lost cause.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So important. Yeah, that was great. Short, sweet, to the point. You know, I love that.
Yeah.
Very, very understandable and relatable. So, you know, if you've come to a lot of these talks in the past, we have talked a lot about leaky gut and that kind of thing. But I love the way you pulled in the studies along with the results and new ways of thinking about this, and that it's not just about, oh, I have, you know, bloat, or, oh, I have diarrhea or constipation. There's a lot of down the stream health issues that really need to be addressed. And those results are phenomenal. Let's just have a moment and really acknowledge that.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about how simple the intervention was, but how significant the results were, it really puts into perspective of, because these people weren't going out doing a bunch of HIIT workouts. They weren't doing these crazy diets. It was really just, let's shift your microbiome and let's help to increase some short chain fatty acids and let's see what happens. And it was a pretty amazing outcome. Great.
A couple of questions have come in. One is, what about ghee when you were talking about butters and fats and that kind of thing? What about ghee?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not at all here saying that you can't have saturated fat. I mean, we all love our ghee and our butter and our coconut oil and all that. The thing is, I think more about, well, a few things. One, that you're not overdoing it, so that you have a really nice balance and variety of, you're using olive oil and you're using avocado oil and you're using some ghee and you're using, so you have a nice variety and including enough and adequate fish oil and omega-3s as well. So there's the quantity. So, you know, if you're doing a keto diet, don't be doing all saturated fat, because that's probably not going to be, you know, the best thing if you have this. But the second thing is also make sure that you have a good intact intestinal barrier, because as long as the LPSs are staying inside the lumen, they're not harming anything. They're there. They're natural. It's normal for healthy individuals to have some level of endotoxins in their body. That's just part of it. So the problem is the quantity and also the integrity of the intestinal barrier.
Gotta heal it up. Yep. Gotta heal it up. Any results with MCAS, mast cell activation syndrome?
In terms of the, like using the spores?
Yes. Have you guys done any studies on that? Any clinical observations?
Oh, we haven't done any specific studies on MCAS. However, clinical observations is that, it's interesting. I don't know if Kron's talked about this, but the whole concept of what a silent probiotic is. When somebody has MCAS, typically that's coming from a degraded, a degraded mucus barrier, intestinal permeability. You know, typically that's going to be intestinal dysbiosis like SIBO. You know, that's usually going to be some sort of underlying component. And when that's happening, that person's immune system is on like high alert because these mast cells are there to kind of, they're right there at that epithelial surface trying to, you know, figure out what's friend, what's foe. And they're there to like get ready to go if something comes in. So if you have somebody who has an issue with their mucus layer, anything you're bringing in has to be sorted, like the sorting hat, like Harry Potter, like, is this good? Is this bad? Like, where do I put you? And so anytime you're bringing that in an MCAS person, they have that high potential to react. So if you're bringing in probiotics, whether they're commensal or not, you know, good probiotics or not, you know, you ingest them, your body still has to figure out what to do with them. And so probiotics in general have the potential to be to activate the immune system. The spores, what's unique about the spores is they don't activate the immune system. So they actually don't activate that, you know, when a dendritic cell is engulfing them, they don't activate the immune response like other probiotics can. And we've seen that actually in other data. And there also our Zenbaum dual product, which I think Karan has talked about, or someone's probably talked about, is also a silent probiotic. So it's enshrouded by this layer that keeps the immune system from reacting to it. So it comes in and it does all, it's like the Harry Potter invisibility cloak. It just kind of comes in and goes incognito and does all of its magic without activating an immune response, which is essentially what MCAS is. So yes, so we find good results with, also the IgGs, which help to bind these LPSs. They have a very specific binding to these LPSs and help to eliminate them from the body. But the spores also, you know, if Megaspores is a little strong, we get really great results with the HU58 or the Restore Flora, which are, less number of spores in there, but they work really well to help to rebuild that barrier and start to prevent the endotoxemia.
Is ZenBiome out of stock?
To my knowledge, it's not. It should be in stock. The Zenbiome Dual.
ZenBiome Dual, D-U-A-L.
Yeah.
Tanya, I don't know why you couldn't buy it.
It should be, yeah, it's on Fullscript and it's also available through the microbiome website.
Okay. You just said something about the two other strains or the two other formulations. What was that again?
HU58, which is just the B. subtilis HU58, which was one of the strains that was studied in the study. And then the other one is Restore Flora, which is our formulation that has Saccharomyces boulardii, as well as the HU58, the Bacillus coagulans and Bacillus clausii.
Okay. So, and who would those be appropriate for?
So HU58 is great for, we use it a lot for if we see high ammonia, or if someone is struggling with liver health or detoxification. It's been studied to help to lower ammonia levels. It's been studied in antibiotic associated diarrhea to help with normalizing bowels. We also like to use it because it secretes about 24 different antimicrobials. So if someone just has a lot of opportunistic overgrowth,
Are you saying HU58?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wanted to say it very, very slowly.
Yes.
And is this one that I didn't mean to interrupt, but is this one that you would take, like, give us the protocol. And we ask this frequently about if someone has to do antibiotics,
you can use it. That. Yeah. If someone has to do antibiotics, I would recommend Restore Flora, 2 caps daily. You can do is the dose. You can go higher if someone is really needing a higher amount of Saccharomyces, but 2 caps daily. You wouldn't want to take it, you know, in the same swallow as the antibiotic. I would space it maybe an hour apart, but there are Bacillus clausii, I believe, that is not killed off by antibiotics. It has shown to be resilient. And the S. boulardii can't be killed off by antibiotics. So if you're on an antibiotic regimen, my favorite protocol for antibiotic regimens is 2 capsules of the HU58, 2 capsules of Restore Flora, 2 capsules of Megaspore. And you do that during the course of the antibiotics. And then you do it for whatever the, you know, 3 times, whatever the duration of the antibiotic course was. So if it was a 7-day course, you do that regimen for 21 days after. So that's kind of my little concoction.
Yeah, no, that's really good.
Yeah.
Let's see. I wanted to ask some questions. What's the appropriate dose of Acromantia for daily supplementation? A recent stool test showed insufficiency. Do you think that it can actually repopulate it to the point of where it comes back in a stool test, or is it more complicated than that?
A lot more complicated than that. I've actually done some deep dives into the literature on Acromantia and supplementation. Most of it's done in animals. And what's interesting is there seems to be sort of a level at which, you know, once you hit a certain level within your gut of Acromantia, you don't get more benefit supplementing with Acromantia. At least that's what they have found in the animal trials. The other thing is Acromantia is a strict anaerobe. So it's very, very difficult to, and I know that there are companies out there that do Acromantia. And it's just, it's hard though to have it actually colonize within the GI tract. I've seen, and I've just, you know, just in working with microbiome labs and seeing the biome effects stool testing, I've seen people who have taken Acromantia and been on it for a long time and they still don't have Acromantia in their gut. So, you know, as much as you can do, and I'm not saying it's not helpful because there's definitely benefit that you can gain from, taking Acromantia, but you want to try to have as much support endogenously as possible, because that's really where the most benefit comes from. Just like with short chain fatty acids, you tend to get the most benefit when it's created endogenously versus taking it orally via supplement.
So it's like cut flowers versus a flower that is in the ground.
Correct.
Great analogies today.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's like, somebody's asking, how do spore-based probiotics help if you have SIBO? It doesn't make sense to give you more bacteria. So the overgrowth, remember, is of certain bad players that are actually part of your microbiome anyway. Mm-hmm. So we have to start thinking of it as a community or a choir. It's not one, it's not one thing or another. That's why they're called keystone, because they're like mayors. They're like you were calling them Instagram influencers. What if you don't like social media? Okay, so forget that. Think of them as, you know, good teachers, that kind of thing, that are rallying the good people to support the microbiome.
Exactly.
It's not like, if I take Acromantia, is Acromantia going to increase? And I understand, because I've asked that question myself. It's more of a garden analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like if you want to go plant a vegetable, I mean, case in point, it's time to plant your fall gardens. Well, we were out last weekend, we were digging the soil, we were finding the new soil, we were working, you know, tilling it up, you know, you're working the soil so that when you're ready to then, you know, plant the seeds, it then can have a higher likelihood of growing. So it's a little bit of a paradigm shift.
So what can you do to help grow Acromantia, and what foods in general, and then what foods? And
yeah.
Taking Acromantia, because people have a bottle of it at home, is it unlikely to help me? Does it help at all?
You know, I don't think you're not going to have any harm. You're not going to have any harm taking it. You know, so if you have a bottle at home and you want to take it, by all means, take it. The best ways are going to be, you know, as I mentioned, the spores, the prebiotic, cranberry polyphenols have also been shown to be very helpful with Acromantia. So, you can eat unsweetened cranberries. You can take cranberry extract. It's about, I believe it's 200 milligrams a day, which actually about a quarter of a cup of unsweetened dried cranberries gives you about 120 of those polyphenols. So you're kind of halfway.
It's quite tart, isn't it?
They're not too bad. You definitely want to get unsweetened though, just so that for the blood, the blood sugar aspect, right. But incorporating unsweetened cranberries, intermittent fasting, as I mentioned, is another great way. Acromantia loves intermittent fasting. So there's some diet and lifestyle. But I really just love, just try to get as many of the reds and the purples in, because those red and purple polyphenols tend to be most helpful for most of these bacteria.
And what about kimchi, sauerkraut, et cetera, especially made with purple cabbage? Nice one, Kim.
There you go. Yeah, those fermented foods actually have shown to increase more of the lactobacillus species. So still very beneficial, still very helpful, still wonderful for your gut. Not as specific for Acromantia though. Although if you're using purple cabbage, I suppose you could get some of those polyphenols and get a double whammy, but yeah.
Okay. What's the best time to take prebiotics and probiotics, with or without food? And also remember, teeny tiny baby steps to get started, especially those of you with small intestine bacterial overgrowth, mm-hmm. and you're experimenting with a prebiotic.
Yeah.
So small, you think it's not going to do anything.
Yeah. And that's actually what I recommend. So to answer the first question, probiotics with food. So you want to take these with a meal. For prebiotics, so with Omega Pre, if I'm using it in someone who we suspect SIBO, has SIBO, recovering from SIBO, they might need help, or maybe they've been on a restricted diet for a long time. I have them take the capsules of Omega Pre and open it up and do like an eighth to a quarter of a capsule and put it in a big, 32 to 24 ounce bottle of water and drink that over the course of the day. So you're not getting even one capsule all at once. You're getting a tiny dose spread over the course of the day. So it's your micro dosing essentially with your Omega Pre. So that's a strategy that I've used clinically that works well. And then you just, as you're working on that overgrowth or you're working on their tolerance issues, you can build on that, but that way they're getting a little bit, but you're not overloading their system. Cause yes, you do want to go low and slow with it.
Definitely. Can the 4 to 5 hour release of LPS after a meal be used as timing for binders? Also being careful to be avoiding of supplements when have been taking. So we're throwing LPS around a lot. Let's go ahead and redefine it, if you would, for us, what it is. And then if they come out, so to speak, 4 or 5 hours after a meal, is that a good time for a binder?
Yeah. Great question. So you're only going to have LPSs in circulation if you have a degraded intestinal barrier. So that's the only reason why you would see these coming into circulation. In somebody who has a really nice intact barrier system, they aren't going to have all these LPSs floating around. So that's one thing that you have to have two things happen. You have to have overgrowth of these gram-negative bacteria. So all bacteria are divided into two big groups, gram-negative and gram-positive. And these gram-negative species have this LPS as part of their membrane. And LPS is basically a fat sugar. It's a lipopolysaccharide. It's a fat sugar. And it's the fat, that lipid A portion, that's the toxic element that the body grabs to bring into circulation if you have this, more permeable, membrane. So just to reiterate that there's a few factors that have to be there in order for this to be a problem. So that's what an LPS is. And they tend to, so for binders, we recommend, and what I really like about the IgGs, which are the serum bovine derived immunoglobulins, is that it's specific to bind to these LPSs. It's not like a charcoal that's just a magnet that will bind to anything and everything. This IgG, this immunoglobulin, is very specific for things like C. diff and Shigella, and because it's whatever the cow has been exposed to. So it's like the cow's immune system. And so LPSs are also one of those things that it'll bind to. So what I'll do is I actually will put IgG like in my water bottle, or I'll tell people just put in your water bottle and drink it all day. That way you're getting some binding action with a meal. You're getting it after a meal. You're getting it 4 hours after a meal. So you can kind of do it that way too, just for simplicity's sake, or you can take it with a meal or you could take it 4 hours after, but I usually recommend kind of having it throughout the day.
If you have low IgA, is there anything we can do? Can we do the IgG? Does that help? What's IgA and IgG? Talk to us about those initials.
Yeah. So secretory IgA is in all of our mucus barriers. So it's in our gut mucus, it's in our nose mucus, it's in our eyes. It's just in all of those mucus barriers. And it's like a soldier that's just marching around all those mucus barriers, waiting for something to come in that shouldn't come in. And so then it mounts a response whenever it looks to say, oh, that's something that we don't want. So it's basically our barrier protective mechanism. IgG is just a different type of immunoglobulin, but taking IgG isn't going, it doesn't have systemic action. So taking IgG won't elevate your systemic IgGs. It won't elevate your serum IgAs. It won't elevate any of your immunoglobulins. It's a very large molecule, which is why it's so effective at binding these LPSs. And then it doesn't go through that layer. It will just carry these on out and take them out for elimination. So it won't help with the IgA. However, as I mentioned in the last slide, you can do things like, colostrum and Saccharomyces boulardii. The spores can help with increasing secretory IgA. Working on that barrier system can help with IgA, help working on the mucus integrity can also help. Yep.
Okay. I would say, what do you say about people who are doing SIBO treatments and they want to do the spores? Dr. Seebecker says, don't start it after a successful negative SIBO breath test. Like you've gotten there, don't mess with it. But prior to that and during treatment, it's fine, but go low and slow. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think anyone who has a sensitive stomach, you just would want to go, and especially with SIBO, go low and slow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Then you can open up the capsules if you needed.
Absolutely. What about people like Evelyn, who is low SIGA and underweight, which would, how does it, so you talked about it balancing people's weight that had too much visceral fat. What about people who are underweight?
So the nice thing about spores and short chain fatty acids is that they're adaptogenic. They're like your gut adaptogens. They aren't going to push you. So you're not going to lose more weight. If you know, you take the spores and the prebiotic, it's not that kind of thing. It's because it's working on gene expression. So you're working more on reducing inflammation and all that type of thing. So it's not going to, you know, you're not going to further lose weight if you're taking it. In fact, it may actually help with some of the, you know, the absorption and just helping, you know, I don't know, you know, what else is going on, but if you have inflammation, it'll just help with rebalancing that. So it's more about a balancing act versus a driving something one direction or the other very strongly.
Okay. And let's see, would you take IgG even if SIGA is elevated?
Yes, because it won't affect your IgA.
Okay, great. Okay. Does HCl and enzymes impact whether the keystone species stick?
So spores are resistant to stomach acid and enzymes. So that's one of the beauties about spores is that you can take them and they're going to make it through all those digestive checkpoints and they're able to get into the colon and do all their work. So that won't affect it. Are they asking if, so taking supplemental HCl and enzymes, if that affects it?
I think so. I think that was it.
Okay. I haven't seen any data on taking, I mean, enzymes definitely won't because enzymes are natural and we need enzymes and HCl, I don't believe that would have any, I can't even think of any mechanism for that. Now having low stomach acid or having something like H. pylori and can definitely affect the composition of our microbiome because you've lost that protective barrier. So you're allowing more of these, you know, bacteria to translocate from the mouth to the colon, as well as if you're not breaking down your food very well, and you have these larger substrates making it to the colon and over fermentation, that's going to also shift the pH, which shifts your microbial balance. So no, but I, in terms of taking, you know, bitters or HCl or enzyme, you should be fine with that.
So somebody was asking, so if it turns out you don't have SIBO, this is the thing about the spores and SIBO, guys, you can take it and experiment with it to see if it's a fit for you anytime. Dr. Allison Seebecker, a SIBO expert, as we know and love, suggests that if you have gotten through a successful multiple rounds of SIBO treatment and you're finally like, I'm SIBO negative, yay, right? Which we all know for 2/3 of the people, that's tough to get there. She wouldn't start any probiotics right after that. She wants, but up to that point, feel free to experiment because there are people out there, Dr. Horlack, Dr. Jacoby, who do work with a variety of probiotics to help patients get well, although I know they also do some killing. So this is, we're talking about the snowflakes. It's so personal. The only caveat is go low and slow, and I wouldn't do it after you finally get that SIBO negative breath test, if that's when you're starting a probiotic. Also keep in mind that Dr. Mark Pimentel, I asked him specifically, when you get rid of the SIBO, right, the overgrowth of the certain bacterias or archaea, does the microbiome come back into balance? And his answer was yes, right? But you still need to support the microbiome and the gatekeepers and keystone. It's very, very important. Remember when we were hunters and gatherers and farmers, we would go out, we'd pick the potato and the carrot out of the ground, we'd basically be re-inoculating every day. So when people ask, well, how long do I have to do this for? Well, are you going to the yard and picking your fruits and veggies, or do you need to support your microbiome with probiotics? So those are my thoughts. What do you say?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one thing I'll tell people when they ask how long. It's like, well, it's how your diet and lifestyle and stress levels are. You know, if you have a good whole foods diet and you're getting dirty and getting out there in the soil and you're managing stress levels, then yeah, you can get away with less. And then some people, their diet or life or their, you know, lifestyle may not allow them to do that. But yeah, and with the spores, you know, the unique thing about the spores is they don't really become active until they get to the colon. So they're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna really do much. They stay kind of pretty dormant, you know, until they get to that lower end of the small intestine into the colon. So as long as you're starting really low and slow with it, you should be okay.
Okay. Would IgG bind medications? 7 minutes to go, guys.
No.
Okay. And best protocol for postmenopausal weight gain and constipation?
That is a big question. Postmenopausal.
It's a huge question. Yeah.
I mean, metabolic. So postmenopausal weight gain and you said insulin resistance?
Constipation.
So, you know, I think, well, for one thing, you want to make sure that you're really addressing all the metabolic health, like what we just talked about today. So you want to make sure they have a really strong, because hormones and, you know, having less hormones and, you know, all losing out on the effects of what hormones do, because hormones in our gut, they interact all the time. So when you lose out on those hormones, you lose out on some of those signals. And so you want to make sure that someone has a really nice intact, you know, barrier system, figure out the root cause of their constipation. Is it SIBO? Is it a water intake problem? Is it a fiber issue? Is it low short chain fatty acids? You know, so there's a lot of different things, as you guys, I know, have talked about over the years with various providers on here, that there's a many, many different reasons for having constipation. So figure out what that is,
right?
And then make sure that you're working on the inflammation piece, supporting their gut barrier system, their LPS levels.
I just want to tell everybody, if you haven't already at least experimented with Megaspore, or you're already a huge fan, if you haven't experimented yet, I personally would. I know it made a huge difference for me. And I'm glad that we have the 15% off for everything in your cart from Microbiome Labs. So Clarissa is posting it periodically in the chat. I'll have her do it again, or just keep scrolling up. We will be sending a replay out, and we will have that coupon scenario there. You do have to use these very specific instructions, so you do get the discount. It's something that we don't know how long will last. We're just very, very grateful for it, and it can be a significant savings. So that's what I wanted to tell you. Also, if you wanted to get like a vaginal microbiome test or a stool test from Microbiome Labs, that coupon and discount does apply as well. We are basically out of time. I wanted to say one more question. Does it help with microscopic colitis?
I've used it in various lymphocytic, microscopic, ulcerative. I've used it in all the colitises, and it can be helpful, especially because colitises tend to be also a degradation of that mucus barrier. So anything you can do to support that. So the Mega Marine, which is our fish oil, and Mega Mucosa, which is another product that's specific for helping to rebuild that mucus layer. Those would be a couple other things I would consider, along with the Megaspore.
Okay. If you want an effective SIBO treatment summed up, get the book. It's $20 on Amazon. I mean, if you want it summed up, because there are three different ways to treat it: herbs, antibiotics, or elemental diet. It's more than I can do in the next like 4 minutes. The coupon does not work in the UK, unfortunately, at this time. And how long do you take Megaspore for? And what were recap for us in this final few moments, what the study dosages were.
So the study was looking at just one of the fibers that's in Megapre, the xyla oligosaccharide. And then it was looking at two of the spores that are in Megaspore at 3 billion CFU. So it wasn't exactly a Megaspore Megapre study, but it used all the components that are in Megaspore and Megapre. Right. So our typical recommendation for Megaspore is you take it 2 caps daily for 3 months. And then you can titrate back down to just maybe once or twice a week as an ongoing maintenance. Same thing with Megapre, take that for about 2 to 3 months, and then you titrate back to just once or twice a week. So that's part of our total gut restoration program. And then the Mega Mucosa is that third component. take one serving a day, about 3 months, and then you titrate down to once or twice a week. So maintenance is just once or twice a week.
So that's really good to know. And then also, can you go the distance for the 3 months, or don't give up before the miracle? Okay.
Yeah.
Because we're not used to doing that. We're used to take these and call me in the morning, take this for 7 days, take it for 10 days. You have a UTI, here's 7 days. So try to, like, I'll never forget, I had the yoga studio and, there were two people there. I was selling Chinese herbs at the time. I've been into health food and supplements since I was 15 years old. Anyway, this was in the 80s. So forgive me for those of you born in the 80s, but here's the deal. One woman said, I said, oh, how long do you think you're going to give it a try? And woman said 2 weeks. And the other woman said 2 years. So I just want to give you like a question about your perspective on things. How long did it take all of us to get in this situation? It's not going, we're talking about a garden. You plant a plant, it's not going to bloom overnight. It needs to take root. It needs to do its thing. It's not magic, it's science. And so give yourself the time and permission to heal. I remember also this little saying that I have when I don't want to do something, like I take my B12 vitamin shots and I don't like needles. And then I say to myself, Siobhan, you're trying to accomplish something. This is not just something you're doing without an intention. Go back to the intention. Oh, right. Okay. And that gets me to do it every time. I don't know if that helps you or not, but why is so important. So whatever is your why, short-term discomfort, long-term gains. Thank Absolutely. You, Alicia.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I had a blast here talking with you guys and hope you gather some clinical pearls along the way.
Well, we appreciate you. Thank you so much. What a delight. We'll have you back very soon. I have no doubt.
I'm happy to do it.
Oh, I appreciate it. Okay. Feel free to put some love into the chat for Alicia. And thank you all very much for joining us. And you will be receiving this replay in an email. So enjoy, take advantage of this very generous offer from Microbiome Labs. We really appreciate them. They've been a great partner to us ever since I started this work 6 years ago. And I hope everyone not just gains information and insight, but also transformation and inspiration to do the work. Because seriously, those results were remarkable based on that study. That's really encouraging. It's not just about the supplement graveyard. It's not just about, what the heck, maybe it works, maybe it won't. That's why I want you to really try it for the 3 months. I want you to go the distance so you can have your own results. Okay. Yes. Wonderful. Claire, I agree with you. Mwah! Talk to y'all soon. Okay.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Petunia says bye. Sort of, she's sleeping. All right. Bye, everybody. Thanks, Clarissa.